For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Today, though, we're back in Genesis chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel. And just because it's been, I think, a month since I've been here to teach, I thought we'd get up to speed just a little bit on the theme that is driving the book of Genesis, which is basically God's blessing out of failure. And that's the pattern that all of the narratives in the book of Genesis are patterned after. And so even the creation story begins with the earth being formless and void, that is chaotic and lifeless. And God, in that environment, speaks order and life into the world. And at the end of each creative day is the conclusion, it was good, it was good. And then finally, when humanity is created uniquely in the image of God, it was very good. And then in chapter 3, there is the human failure, the rebellion against God, Adam and Eve deciding that they're gonna go their own way, to their own destruction, and yet out of that destruction that they bring upon themselves and the rest of humanity, God is at work there, promising that there would be a descendant that would come out of Eve that would exact retribution against the serpent, Satan, who is the impetus behind the rebellion against God. Then in chapters 4 and 5, we have the failure of Cain against slaying his brother Abel, and then God then working through the line of Seth. And then in chapters 6 through 9, the failure of humanity that brought about the flood, but the provision of God, the blessing of God through Noah in chapters 6 through 9. Then in chapters 10 and 11, the failure of humanity after the flood, each going their own way and culminating in the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, in which humanity decides that they're literally going to build a tower into heaven, which God is not okay with and is futile anyway, but then he scatters in judgment the peoples to the corners of the earth. To be followed then by this incredible blessing in Genesis 12, where God calls Abraham and says, through you, all of the families of the earth will be blessed. And that's what the game plan is then for Genesis, is how is God going to create from Abraham a nation that will be that blessing to the world, that as far as the curse goes, God's blessing will follow. So that's the pattern of the book of Genesis. We're in an especially dark period here in Genesis chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel. It's familiar to us, I think. It's certainly recognized in popular art through the centuries of the church. And now we take a look at the text. Chapter 4, verse 1, Adam and Eve had relations, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. She said, I have gotten a son with the help of the Lord. Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Abel tended flocks, but Cain tilled the ground. When it was time for the harvest, Cain presented some of his crops as a gift to the Lord, and Abel also brought a gift, the best of his firstborn lambs from the flock. The Lord accepted Abel and his gift, but he did not accept Cain and his gift. And Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. Why are you so angry? The Lord asked Cain. Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Well, one day Cain suggested to his brother, hey, let's go out into the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Afterward, the Lord asked Cain, where is your brother? I do not know, Cain responded. And now that most famous line that everyone knows, am I my brother's keeper? But the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are cursed and banished from the ground, which has swallowed your brother's blood. No longer will the ground yield good crops for you, no matter how hard you work. From now on, you will be a homeless wanderer. Cain replied to the Lord, my punishment is too great for me to bear. You have banished me from this land, from your presence. You have made me a homeless wanderer, and anyone who finds me will kill me. Well, the Lord said, no, for I will give sevenfold punishment to anyone who kills you. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain to warn anyone who might try to kill him. So Cain left the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. All right. Watch out for your brother. That's the theme of this story. I'm a younger brother, so I kind of, this speaks to me here. Always looking over my shoulder at my brother. Really, it begins with the story of two sacrifices, Cain's sacrifice and Abel's sacrifice. And I think it's important just to take a minute here to talk about why the sacrifices. What's the purpose of this? What's the point of the whole sacrifice thing? You see it all over the Old Testament. You see it all over every religion that ever was, really is involved in sacrifice. What's the deal here? The real deal here is the contrast we need to make between appeasement and trust. Appeasement, which is to say that all sacrifices in religion outside of the Bible are there for the purpose of appeasing the gods, however those gods might be defined, and to appease their anger, their wrath, or to provide for them their meals, which was really literally the understanding in the ancient Near Eastern world that a sacrifice is there because the gods are hungry. And if you don't feed them, they'll exact retribution on you. So it's always about this idea of trying to manipulate gods to either perform for you or stay out of your business, to keep them at a safe distance from you, to appease them. The difference in the Bible is that sacrifices are evidences of trust. And that's really what's at the backdrop to this story here and is really the foundation for why Cain and Abel's sacrifice was so significantly different. In the case of Cain, at harvest time, it says, he gave some of his crop as a gift to the Lord. For his brother Abel, who tends the flock, it says that he gave the best of the firstborn lambs. And so this whole idea of giving the fatted lamb to the Lord is not because God gets hungry, he's got to have it, but because it's a statement of trust, the belief in the God. The question is God good? Is God worthy of the best of my crops or the best of my cattle or whatever it is that is of value to me that I can then give to the Lord to say, God, I trust you. I believe that you have my best interest in mind. And to demonstrate that trust, I'm going to take something that really matters to me and I'm going to devote it to you. I'm going to give it over to you. That's what sacrifice means in the context that we're reading it here. And really that we see all over the book of Genesis. We're going to come encounter other elements of sacrifice as well when we get to Genesis 22 and to other passages that we need to look at. This is the background. It's a real statement where we take something of value to us and we say, God is worthy. I trust God. And that I believe that if I go all in with God and truly give him my best, that is exactly the best possible thing for me to do. And that's an important part of this, that I give something of value, not only as a celebration of God's goodness, but it puts me at a place of vulnerability. If I give God my best, then I'm suffering real loss. And if I'm suffering real loss, is God going to be able then to come through and meet those pressing needs that I really do have? Well, here's a question, not just for Cain and Abel, or for the generations that would come after them. It's the question that relates to us as well. Because God calls on us, similarly, to make sacrifice. And the question that we have to ask is, can I be all in for God? Can I present the sacrifice that he calls me to, knowing that God's best good for us will be affected by that very thing. It is that very statement of trust and that placing ourselves in a position of vulnerability that actually enables us to experience God in that deep and transforming way, in a way that is not going to happen without this kind of sacrifice. That's really at the heart, not only of Old Testament spirituality, but of New Testament spirituality as well. I like what Paul says in this very important passage in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. He says, "Dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies, not your crop or the fatted calf or whatever, but give your bodies to God because of all that he has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind that he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him." You want to ask this question: what's pleasing to God? What does it mean for us to really worship him? It isn't to offer up a little token of our esteem, a little piece of our crop or whatever. Paul says, if you really want to know what it means to accord to God what is appropriate to give him your whole self. Hold nothing back. Present yourselves as a sacrifice to him. He says, don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into the new person by changing the way you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good, pleasing, complete. I love the way that the New Living Translation puts that. Look, here's the thing. What happens if I decide, you know, I've been kind of sniffing around the edges of the Christian life for as long as I can remember. And it's always been sort of like I've got my agenda. And I realize, you know, God's got his agenda, and I've been trying to kind of straddle the fence and give God a little bit. But really, where's my head at? What do I value? What am I living for? What am I all in for, really? It's my thing. I mean, let's just be honest. That's where so many of us have been in our life. Maybe many of us here tonight also are aware that we are really trying to serve a double agenda in life. We're trying to give God what's his, but really we're also seeking to cover ourselves and to make sure that what we really have is plenty of time, plenty of resources, plenty of passion and zeal for stuff that's just totally about me. And the symptom of that, how do you know that you're there? Well, very few of us have the honesty to say, you know, I've really been playing my cards both ways for my whole Christian life. We don't usually say that. But what we do is we feel something. We feel distant from God. Sometimes when we're in Christian fellowship, maybe at a meeting like this where the word is being taught or in our home churches or whatever, we get this sort of momentary sense of, oh, yeah, the God thing, that's so good, that's so true, that's so real. And there's a poignancy about it. It's like, oh. And then a couple days later, it's like, yeah, that was really interesting. And then several days after that was, what was it that was really speaking to me? And then a week after that, it's like it never happened. How about you? Are you like that? Well, what that means is that you're like so many of us who are struggling in this area. That we're giving to God what's comfortable for us. But we're not all in. We're not offering up ourselves, our agenda, our life to the things of God, to say to God, here I am, and I'm available to you, and I will follow you, God, as you speak to me through your word, as you move with your spirit in me and fill me with a sense of clarity and passion for things, as you bring your people into my life to provide that kind of wisdom and insight about what does it mean for us to come together and to really serve Christ together. I'm in. I want to do that. I want to go there with you, God. That's what he's talking about here. That's what it means to really offer up sacrifice to God. It's not to appease him, to feed his lunch, to just make sure that he knows you're thinking about him once a week or whenever it is. It's to symbolize this deep place in the heart where we're saying, I am fully devoted to you. In religion, sacrifice is ritual. It's highly ritualized. It's usually done by priests and people who are officials of the religion. There are ways of doing it and ways of not doing it. It's all very symbolic and stuff. But from the Bible's point of view, while there is in the Old Testament priests and they follow a prescribed thing because of its symbolic value, what it's teaching about having access to God, the real underlying issue involved in sacrifice is not because it satisfies certain kind of rituals, but rather because it really connects us relationally to God. That's the point. And so it's the relationship that we're really talking about here. Love the way Hosea puts it in Hosea 6:6. He says, this is God speaking, I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. You know, God is not so trivial as to be somehow moved by people loading up a bunch of flesh and setting it on fire. It's like, wow, you know, where's the love? It's so cool. That's not the point. The point is that relational thing, that trust, that desire of his people to have real knowledge of him, to have real loyalty, and I'm in with you, God. That's what I'm really all about. That's what this is describing here. So when we talk about Cain and Abel's sacrifice, it's with that kind of backdrop in mind. And here, Cain encounters failure. The Lord accepted Abel and his gift, but did not accept Cain and his gift. What's up with that? What does that mean? Well, it means that Cain becomes very angry. What? That's my really great green thing. Not good enough for you, God? And it says he became angry. And why did he become angry? And why did he become angry at Abel? Well, because this sacrifice really revealed something deep within Cain that was profoundly flawed. You know, probably from the outside up to this point, if you were a friend of the Adam family, yeah, that's good. And, you know, you knew Cain and Abel, the brothers, you'd say, you know, they're both really pretty nice fellas. They're okay. You know, they seem very appropriate and so forth. Say the right things at the right times. Nice guys. But then there is this moment where there is this time for sacrifice, and God sees what we don't see. And what God saw was something in the heart of Cain that was unworthy and that was just totally uncool. And so he points this out and he says, Cain, that's not an acceptable sacrifice. And this enrages Cain. Because why? Because there's something deep within Cain, which is this assumption that if I just throw whatever, you know, at God, then I'm doing the right thing. I'm appeasing him. He should be happy in his heaven as I am on my earth. And just let's keep it that way. And God's like, I'm not okay with that. And so this flaw that was in the heart of Cain really comes to the surface through the act of sacrifice. And so he becomes angry. And then it says, interestingly, it says that his countenance fell. It means literally that his head just kind of went down. Why does your head sink like this? It's because you're having an emotional reaction to an inward process, an inward reality. So the anger that he felt that came out of the wickedness really of his own heart was matched then by an emotional response, a shame response. And that becomes then a very important issue and something that we need to talk about. Because he goes on, he says, look, And God warns Cain at this point. He says, you need to understand that sin is crouching at your door and its desire is for you. Such a fascinating statement. As though sin is this active property, this active reality that actually has this internal homing device that is able to scope out the weaknesses in our heart and then move right toward them, calling us in our weakness to sin, to violate God's design and God's purpose for us in a fallen and broken world. You know what? That's exactly right. That there is an active influence on our fallen nature, our fallen self. That's what sin is. It's that voice that gets in your head that says, the God thing, it's a bunch of crap. The God thing, he wants too much. Why does he want all my stuff when he has the heavens and the earth? The God thing, why should I go his way when I'm perfectly content going my own way? And whatever narrative it is that resonates deep in your soul, resonates deeply in other people's as well, and certainly in Cain's. And so we have, by virtue of our fallenness, you know, this is the time of year for me, there's this invisible stuff. Well, it's not really invisible, but it's not really visible to the naked eye. Pollen. Okay? Man. It doesn't matter how many drugs I take. From about now until early June, I'm a basket case. Because these pollens, they get in my system and they cause me to sneeze and wheeze. So I take medications that make me stupider and stupider and stupider. And I'm just affected by this pollen, like we're all affected by sin. It has that same very active property that just works on us. And so, where are you vulnerable? Where do your allergies lie? Well, that pollen is going to find you out, and it's going to affect you. And so God is just telling Cain, he's like, man, I'm warning you. You're vulnerable here. This anger that you're displaying, this shame response that you're having, that's not helping. That's a victory for this sin that is seeking you out. Your emotions, to the point about his countenance falling, are fallen as well. There's something wrong with your emotional life. How could that possibly be? Nothing could be more genuine than how I feel, right? Nothing could be truer than how I feel. Unless, of course, our feelings are just full of falsehood, and which they are. Often, when we buy the narrative that sin brings to us, we begin to have emotional reactions. And our emotions can range in a lot of ways. You know, for Cain, it was he became explosively angry. For some of us, our emotional reactions are to become withdrawn and depressed. And some of us have the emotional reaction of just kind of burying our head in the ground and trying to stimulate ourselves not to think about the things that bother us. But we have all got this problem. In our culture, this is the most emotionally oriented culture, I think, that there ever was. And so we can talk, you know, it's so backwards, it's so bizarre. We can talk in our culture about how truth is relative to the individual. You know, there is no real truth. We just kind of, we all create our own story. So it doesn't matter what your story is or mine. It's all, we're all true in our own way. But you know the thing, so truth doesn't matter. But what really does matter, it's how I feel. And if I feel whatever it is I might feel, I have to stay true to that. I must stay true to that, because to be true to how I feel is to be true to myself, and therefore how I feel and who I am are one and the same. Do you see how dangerous that is? How many of you have kids? And you remember sometimes how they feel. And you say, oh, that's true for you, son. Oh, man, really? No. And so there's something very insidious about this, something very dangerous indeed, where we are able to, the whatever weakness is in there, that this thing called sin will find us out. How we respond to that is going to really determine our emotional makeup, our emotional life. And we can find ourselves in a real world of hurt real fast. We can find ourselves mastered by a pattern of real failure in this area, where we are listening to the counsel of our fears. We are listening to the counsel of our desires, however broken they are. And that narrative that we've created for ourselves imprisons us, limits our freedom to such an extent that we feel that we just cannot get out of this. You're this way, and so am I. We have this disease in our family. It's called lethalitis. Okay? Why? Because I'm sure there's a genetic component to it, but there's also an awful lot of strong-willed people who do the wrong, stupid thing over and over, and a culture of lethalitis that reinforces the stupidity of it. And, you know, so we're a pretty foolish lot. And so we are given to listening to our emotional life as it says, you're depressed, people suck, time to withdraw. And you're like, yes, sir, yes, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so we listen to that stuff. Most of my dad's siblings died in total alienation from everyone around them, including their own children. That is where it will go for me and for my kids if we listen to that broken inner voice that says, this is who you are. This is just the way it is. Do you understand what I'm saying? Are you with me on this? Do you hear me? I wonder, I worry. Do you hear me? Because this is a huge deal. We have all made prisoners of ourselves by our own device. And God is warning Cain, sin is crouching at your door and its desire is for you. And then he moves on and he says, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted? And so he offers him some hope here. He's not saying, you know, you are utterly enslaved to the things that drive you and it can't be any other way. He's not saying that. He's saying indeed that take yourself in hand, man. You've got some choices to make here. There is hope. What do we do? The psalmist cries out to the Lord. I've read this so many times. I can't tell you how many times I've read this. This is the path to mental health right here. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed within me? I'm telling you, that's a good question. This is not inevitable that we slide into these places where we are just driven by our egos, or we're in the shattering place of despair, or we're so lonely we'll do anything for affection, or whatever it is. The psalmist says we need to ask ourselves a question when we're in that place. Why are you in despair? Why have you become disturbed within me? How well do you know yourself? How adept are you at asking this question? Examining yourself, not in some introspective way, but in an honest way that really gets at what is this thing that's driving me? Can you connect the dots? Here's an important question. If you walk away having really maybe thought about something tonight, My hope is that it would be this. Have you been able to connect the dots in your life, the failures in your life, the things that really have held you down in your life, and have you connected those dots with some real flaws within your own character and that these dots are merely the extension of, the expression of? Do you know yourself well enough to know the broken thing that drives you? Why are you in despair, oh my soul? God wants to give us answers to that question. Doesn't want to leave us in the dark. Wants to put us at a place where the light of truth can shine on these hurtful ways within so that we can make choices and things can be different. We may feel ourselves to be deeply enslaved by a way of thinking and a way of life here tonight. And I'm here to tell you that you are a handful of really good decisions away from real freedom in that area. That's the reality. But I also want to warn you with this passage in the other direction, that we're also several really bad decisions from a deeper and deeper hole that we're digging for ourselves. And God is calling on Cain, and he's saying, man, don't go there. He says, if you do well, he says, you must master it. What do we do? He's saying there's something we can do about these states that we find ourselves in. What do we do? Well, we go back to the God question and say, God, what do you have for me? Thank you for bringing this to my attention so that I'm not a fool who's being driven blindly by my own broken inner life, that you have loved me enough to make me feel tension with where I am. My emotional life, as broken as it is a window into my soul. So thank you for bringing this to my attention. And then to learn, what does it mean to trust God in these very broken areas of our life, those areas where sin has its real foothold in us? And we can do that in a very practical way as we allow God to examine our heart through a contemplation of His Word. That's what it is, being in His Word, seeking godly advice from people who know us well, and saying, help me think this through. Help me find the path to freedom in my life. And God is diligent, and God is able to bring people who help us bear one another's burdens and to bear with one another and to really find that place of victory in our life. It's not inevitable. Well, Cain went a different direction, and he attacked his brother Abel, and he killed him. So bad news for him. But here's the problem. When God confronts him, what does he say? He says, where's your brother? As though somehow God doesn't know. He's good at asking those questions. Remember in the garden after they ate from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, good and evil, and God's like, so where are you? Oh, I heard you coming, and I ran off the path to hide myself. Oh. By chance, have you eaten from that tree I told you not to eat from? You see, asking these questions, not because he's ignorant, but to drive the point home. Man, where are you? Well, Cain says, and this is really the heart of the problem right here, my friends, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? What's he doing here? He's basically saying, you know, whatever happened to Abel, it ain't my problem. It's not my responsibility. It's just a thing. And, oh, we're so good at that. When it becomes clear that there's no running from the fact that you done it, what's the first thing you do? Well, you see, it's her fault. You know, the circumstances. If you just understood, then you would agree with me. Or whatever it is you say, that's what Cain is saying here. am I my brother's keeper? Really, how lame. And not inevitable either. I want to talk to you about another murderer. A murderer who is in many ways a worse murderer by far than Cain. A murderer who was in a position of power, virtually undisputable human power. And he gazed from his place of privilege on the object of his desire, a woman that he became infatuated from at a distance. And that lust in his heart drew him to act out in violence toward her husband. And this man had him killed. And then he took the woman to be his own wife. And this is, of course, David. And David's response when Nathan the prophet came to him and he said, I got a story to tell you, David. Because David's probably thinking, you know, nobody knows about this thing. It's just what is done. There's plausible deniability in the story, whatever. And Nathan said, there's this guy who was poor, and he went to this rich man's house because a traveler had come and to stay with him. And according to the, you know, ancient Near Eastern protocol, you have to offer hospitality, but he had no food. And so he goes to this man, you know, asking for the thing, for a lamb or whatever. No, you can't have that. I got it backwards. He goes to the rich guy who's unwilling to give up from his bountiful herd and goes to the poor guy with one lamb and says, I'm going to take your lamb for this wayfarer. My only lamb, the lamb that sleeps with me in bed at night. You know, take that away. He kills it and serves it to the guy. And David is so pissed. He goes, how? That guy is so totally unrighteous, so totally unfair, so totally wrong. That man deserves to die. Really worked himself up into a lather. Till Nathan said, thou art the man. And David's like, oh, I'm busted. I'm the rich guy who stole from the poor guy. And what did David do? He didn't say, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? This is what he did. He said in Psalm 51, forgive me for shedding blood, O God who saves. Forgive me, O God who saves. Then I will joyfully sing your forgiveness. Unseal my lips, O Lord, that my mouth may praise you. David was no more guilty than Cain. But look at the response and how different that is and the difference in the trajectory of life. Cain complained from the minute he was busted about his bad sacrifice, about the murder, about God's confronting him. He makes this lame excuse about, you know, now I'm a marked man and all this kind of stuff. And it's just one excuse after another. That's really the problem. He didn't have humility, my friends. He lacked humility. Just to say, when you speak, God, you're right. I got nothing. I got no excuse, no explanation, nothing. All I can do is just agree with you that I'm guilty. And then seek out your forgiveness, which you are utterly willing to give. You never hold back forgiveness to anyone who has the humility to ask for it. How about you here tonight? Some of you have been coming, you've been thinking this through, you've been hearing these teachings for a while. There's little left to explain to you that you don't already know. But you're not in God's kingdom yet. Because why? Because you're still standing in your pride. You're still hopping from one issue to another, and you're keeping God at his distance. And you're more like Cain than David right now. But that doesn't have to stay that way. And what about right now doing what David did and just humble yourself to say, God, I'm guilty. There's nothing I can do to make me not guilty. And I trust that you're the kind of God that David describes right here, a God who does forgive. and I want your forgiveness. Will you forgive me on the basis of the blood of Christ? See, that's what real humility is, and that's the end of the issue between you and God. At that point, God is pleased with you. God is pleased to call you his son or his daughter simply on the basis of what he has done for you in Christ. That's the issue. For Cain, it's a different thing. His life just was a working out of his own hardness toward God. Cain's legacy is a bad legacy. Let me just end on this point. Genesis 4 goes on, and it describes his family. The greatness that is his family, in fact. Cain, he goes on, he's no longer a farmer, so he builds a city. One of his sons, named Jabal, became the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock, so like Bedouins. Jubal was another one of his sons, was the father of those who play the lyre and the pipe, so music. It comes from these guys. Then there's this other guy, Tubal Cain, who was the forger of implements of bronze and iron. And so these guys were pretty productive. They were great. Why? Because they maintained the image of God. That's true. We can sin and we can revolt against God. We can corrupt ourselves profoundly, but there's a greatness that is humanity. And his family had that. But they also had Cainitis. And so the last installment on the Cain legacy is Lamech. In verse 23, who boasts to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Listen to my voice, give heed to my speech. I've killed a man for wounding me, a boy for striking me." It's a boast. So whereas Cain fled his descendant Lamech, this guy looked at me crooked and I slew him. And so you just see the hardness that's a part of this line. And we'll see the end of this line in the next chapter. Well, actually chapter 6, because there's nobody in this line that survives the flood. God is moving in judgment against the brokenness, the fallenness, the folly and the rebellion of humanity. That's the reality of the situation. Some conclusions for us to consider here tonight. First, I think we have a very penetrating picture of the human inner life. Who can't relate to what's going on with Cain? Only those who are unself-aware, that's who. We all know what it means to be pulled down by the sin that is earnestly in pursuit of us. And that leaves us then in a place where we need to make some decisions. Who is going to be your master? Who are you going to present your whole self to? What's preventing you from presenting your whole self to God, even here tonight? You know the goodness of God and you've received his forgiveness, but you're not all in. You're holding back. You're saying, I'm thank you for the forgiveness, and now I'm going to go my own way, and it's so dissatisfying. And really, we find that we're wasting time. Are you wasting time in your life? Now is an opportunity just to come before God, like Paul describes in Romans 12, 1 and 2, and just present my whole self to him and say, I'm yours. You have me all. I trust that you'll be leading me and showing me what it means to set aside interests of self to pursue your agenda, your good and perfect and complete agenda that will transform my life. That's a decision that we make. It's not something that happens to us. It's something that God calls on us because we're free choosing agents to cooperate with him in that process of life transformation. And through us, world transformation. Those are the choices we've got. Next week, we're going to talk about the new trajectory for humanity, a different trajectory, not the Cain trajectory, but that other line through the new son that comes out of Adam and Eve, the son Seth, and his line that goes through Noah and his sons and ultimately to Abraham. All right, so there you have it.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.